poke him if I was muted, but I guess I need to speak. But it feels funny because I don't see a lot of people and I don't see the speaker. And I have a feeling of what's going on. But let me start with somebody that I'm most anxious to hear, and I'm sure you are, and you will be even more as he talks, who is Ray Jackendoff. Dr. Jackendoff is has, just from my own standpoint, has been alluring to me in a number of different ways. Sort of, if I put it abstractly, the ability to get multiple parts of the brain, of the head, of the mind, whatever you want to call it, into integration while they're still parts. I mean, that is a central problem. He has a way of doing that that's amazing to me. And he has made thinking and a less formalized appearance of a game that people push around. Let's see, lately, I think, under Wittgenstein's baleful influence, a sense of that you push counters around and make them move and so forth. And he's infused meaning with fact, all the things that we were talking about, from the go-around to the to Morris's talk today, all germane to what he's doing in a most original fashion. He is the Seth Meron Professor Emeritus and former co-director of the Center for Cognitive Studies at Tufts. He's currently a research affiliate in brain and cognitive sciences at MIT. He's written widely on syntax, semantics, the architecture of grammar, the evolution of language, and get this, music cognition, as well as social cognition and consciousness. As a man is interested in all the things that we could possibly be interested in and done original work on it. He has won the Nicole Prize in Cognitive Philosophy, the David Rummelhart Prize for Contributions to Theoretical Foundations of Human Cognition, 5 honorary degrees. He's written a number of books that are really accessible to the layman, I think, as well as books that are properly in his field. I recommend them. Semantics and Cognition, A Generative Theory of Tonal Music. Get that, you know, I think we all sort of wanted something like that, kind of reaching for it. Consciousness and the Computational Mind, Consciousness, Foundations of Language, which is a wonderful book to have. It's a kind of, I think it collects a lot of his ideas together. A User's Guide to Thought and Meaning. And most recently, and Bonnie was interested, I think, in this particularly, The Texture of the Lexicon. Get that. Now, you know, Dr. Jackendoff is not an easy man to grab. He does not, you don't, he's not readily, doesn't, I don't think he's anxious to be on the circuit particularly, and certainly. But one of the things, so I know that I've tried to get him before for the American Psychoanalytic and failed. So I think that it's a particular honor to us that he has agreed. And it's kind of characteristic of him in both occasions, I think, when he's trying to think what one part has to do with another part and how it's integrated, is that whether he agreed or he declined, he wanted to know what was the interest that the organization had in him. He's going to try to bring that together in his own mind. And we're very, very lucky to have him today. I'm very glad he's here. Dr. Jackendoff, welcome.
Thank you. Let me try to share my screen. This will take a moment. What? All right, I think we're in business. Can you hear me?
Loud and clear.
Loud and clear, good. The trouble with this Zoom format is you can't, there are all these junctions that take a bit of time when you don't expect it. makes it a little uncomfortable, but here we go. First of all, I want to thank Larry for this wonderful introduction, and I'm honored to be speaking to this group. Thanks to Paolo and Craig for organizing it. I consider myself basically a theoretical linguist, but it's carried me into all these other crazy areas. And I'll give you a little bit of it today, based primarily on this book that Larry mentioned, A User's Guide to Thought and Meaning. I wrote this with a general audience in mind. It's relatively non-technical, though not always easy. It's only about 200 pages long, and the chapters are about 5 pages each, so you can read them in bed. And it has cartoons. Now, I have to admit that one of the reasons I wrote it this way was sort of displaced aggression against philosophers who have quite different and rigid views of meaning and thought and the mind and so forth. And I found it impossible to get through them. So I just threw to them. So I just took this other approach to see what would happen. Anyway, I'll try to give you the flavor of some of the arguments in there. Some of the ideas are already also in my 1987 book, Consciousness and the Computational Mind, which Larry mentioned. So the question I want to ask is, to start with, is what's it like when you're thinking? And one common intuition is that thinking is talking to yourself. Thought is inner speech. It's the Joycean stream of consciousness. It consists of verbal imagery. So here's a few people expressing that view. First of all, Plato in the Sophist, he says, are not thought and speech the same? With this exception that what is called thought is the unuttered conversation of the soul with herself. And his foil Theaetetus says, quite true. And then he goes on to say, but the stream of thought which flows through the lips and is audible is called speech. True. Okay, so that's Plato. Here's John B. Watson, who I'm sure you think of as the enemy, one of the fathers of behaviorism. He says, the hypothesis that all of the so-called higher thought processes go on in terms of faint reinstatements of the original muscular act, including speech here, is, I believe, a tenable one. Well, of course, he doesn't want to say there's such a thing as thought at all. It's just the muscle activations that give rise to speech. That's all that's going on. It's hard to believe this view held on for as long as it did. Here's the philosopher Peter Carruthers. He says, it's images of natural language sentences which are the primary vehicles of our conscious thoughts. Even my 4.5-year-old son said, I think in English, I can hear myself think. And here's Chomsky. Chomsky says language is not properly regarded as a system of communication. It's a system for expressing thought, something quite different. Language uses largely to oneself, inner speech for adults, monologue for children. And now our friend Wittgenstein, who says, when I think in language, there aren't meanings going through my mind in addition to the verbal expressions. The language is itself the vehicle of thought. What does it mean to talk about the vehicle of thought as opposed to the thought? Well, I'll try to work this out. Now, it's been noticed, of course, that there are problems of this view of thought as inner language. Here's Wittgenstein again. He has somebody saying, so you really wanted to say, and you're tempted to use the following picture. What he really wanted to say, what he meant, was already present somewhere in his mind. That is, it was the thought in his mind even before we gave it expression. Now, and if the thought is the linguistic expression, how can we translate even roughly between languages? Or what are we saying when we say two sentences of the same language mean the same thing? So the lion chased the bear, the active, the bear was chased by the lion, passive. How can they mean the same if they're different utterances? Another question is, how could animals think? And of course, some people say they can't, but if you look at the ethological and experimental literature on primates and crows and dolphins and parrots and so forth, it sure looks like they're doing something that we would regard as thinking. And there's a different intuition that's implied in a couple of the quotes, Chomsky and Carruthers and maybe Wittgenstein, it's hard to tell. which is that language expresses thought, where the thought is something different from the language that expresses it. But then we have to ask, what's the thought that language expresses? We keep digging and getting harder questions as we go. If we address this question, we have to dig deeper and ask, what's language such that it can express thought? And more specifically, what are words and what are sentences? Well, first of all, words and sentences wouldn't exist if there weren't people to use them. So my way of putting the question is, what's going on in people when they speak, when they use language, either speaking or understanding it? And I'll call this the cognitive perspective. So once we get down into the cognitive perspective, we can say a word is a linkage in a speaker's long-term memory between a pronunciation or a phonology, that's what it sounds like and how to produce it, and a concept, which is the word's meaning. Well, what's a concept? We're still in trouble. It's best to approach this by asking what a concept has to be able to do. So besides being able to be being expressed in language, I think a concept basically has to do two things. The first one is what I'll call the referential function. A word allows you to categorize things in the environment. This is a chair, that isn't a chair, this is a dog, that's not a dog, and so forth. But notice there's no direct connection between your concept of a chair and chairs in the environment. You have to perceive an object. You have to encode it in your working memory in order to compare it to the concept. So there's no direct relation between the concept and the world, only mediated by cognitive processes. The other thing that a word meaning has to do, a concept has to do, is the inferential function. Namely, a concept allows you to make inferences. If something is a chair, it looks sort of like this. You can sit in it, blah, blah, blah. If it's a dog, it does such and such. It likes such and such. If it's a sandwich, you can eat it, and so on. And inferences are even involved with things that you see. So you are making the inference unconsciously that if I turn around, I will have a back. I won't be a hollow shell. And this view goes back at least to Helmholtz, the idea of prediction or inference in visual perception. Now, all the inferential patterns among among concepts have to be stored in memory in terms of relations among them. And this pattern of relations is often called a semantic network. So a word is a linkage of a pronunciation that's stored in memory and a concept that's stored in memory. And we can contrast that, and those two pieces are dissociable because a nonsense syllable like thit or squig has a pronunciation that's not linked to a concept. We can have concepts that are not linked to pronunciation. So a few decades ago, there was a little book called Sniglets, and it was a list of things that you knew about, that you know how to use, that you know what they look like, but you don't have words for them. So one example of a sniglet that I have is the strip of, what do you call the strip of lawn between the sidewalk and the curb? I don't have a word for that, but I mow it all the time with a lawnmower. My wife calls it an esplanade, and I say, that's just silly. I can't call it that. Anyway, what this shows is that we can dissociate the pronunciation from the concept, and in linking them together gives us a word. Now, what's a sentence? Well, a sentence is also a linkage of pronunciation and a meaning in a speaker's head, and typically sentences aren't memorized, so this linkage has to be established in working memory. The pronunciation is made up of the pronunciations of the words in the sentence, put in order according to the grammatical patterns of the language. The meaning of the sentence is made up of the meanings of the words in the sentence, plus what I'll call other stuff. These are pieces of meaning that didn't come from the words. Now, what do I mean by the other stuff? Here's some examples. If I say, I'm parked out back, I doesn't mean me, it means my car. Or a famous example of Jeff Nunberg's, the waitress says to another one, the ham sandwich over there wants some coffee. And the ham sandwich, of course, can't want anything. It's the guy with the ham sandwich is the intended meaning. Or my wife says, will you be going by a mailbox? And what she really means is, would you mail some letters for me? So there's some inference in connecting between the literal meaning and the intended meaning. You can even have seriously elliptical sentences. Here's two examples with only one word, and it's the same word, in different visual contexts, but you still get the intended meaning, which is obviously different from the for the two utterances. Here it is. The lady is saying, don't. But in one case, the intention is don't kiss me. The other one is don't step off the roof. Okay, in these terms, we can say two sentences mean the same if they express the same concept, either in the same language or in different languages. The meaning of a sentence has referential properties. It pertains to some situation in the environment, and it has inferential properties. You can draw conclusions and perform actions and assert further sentences based on it. Okay, so what I've done is articulated language into a sound component, the pronunciation, linked to a conceptual component, the meaning, where meaning is the mental structure in terms of which thought takes place. I should mention that you may have noticed I haven't mentioned syntax at all. It plays a rather minor role in this whole story, even though that's sort of what we think of as linguistics mostly, deviating from that. So next I want to ask, what's the experience of inner speech? Remember, Plato and Carruthers and Chomsky and Wittgenstein seem to be saying you experience thought, that is, concepts. I think Watson would say you don't experience anything, but there's no thought. Anyway, back to Plato and Carruthers and so forth, you're experiencing concepts. But if you pay close attention to what you're experiencing, I hope you'll agree with me that it's primarily pronunciation. It's in a language. You can say, do you think in English or in French, like Carruthers' son? It has syllables, it has words, it has word order, it has verb agreement, it possibly even has intonation. That's what you're experiencing. And you could ask, is inner speech necessary for thinking? Could you think without language? Well, again, as I mentioned, evidence suggests that other primates have concepts and that they think. They do categorize things in the world, they draw inferences, they carry out plans, but of course they couldn't have inner speech. What language would it be in? For another angle on the relation of thought and experience, what's the difference between the two ways of understanding the sentence, visiting relatives can be dangerous? In one case, I'm visiting the relatives, and the other one, they're visiting me. But the two ways of understanding it sound the same, they just feel different in some way. The difference in meaning is hidden, but we know it's there. The same thing with translation. So if I say my dog is dead and I say in German, mein Hund ist tot, if you speak German, you just know that they mean the same. It can't be that they invoke a common visual image. The visual image is too specific. The visualized dog has a particular color and is in a particular position. And the visual image isn't specific enough. There's nothing in it that encodes that the dog belongs to me, maybe even that it's dead. What these two sentences have in common is their meaning, but that isn't reflected in the form in which they reach awareness. For another example, which you guys will appreciate, I think, what's happening when you have a tip of the tongue experience? Well, you have a concept. Sure, you're sure you know what you want to say, but it lacks any conscious form. You say, what's that guy's name again? What the heck is the French word for mushroom? You can judge that this word isn't the one you want. You can say, no, it's not salacious. I think it starts with a K. It sounds like da-da-da. And you know when you've got it right. Say, oh yeah, that's it, right? So all of these observations, ellipsis, translation, tip of the tongue, and so forth, add up to what I call the unconscious meaning hypothesis, namely that the experience of inner speech or outer speech basically involves imagery. And it's the imagery of pronunciation. The meaning itself, the computational form that allows you to draw inferences and so forth, is not conscious. This is the central argument of my book, The Consciousness and the Computational Mind. And it's been picked up in recent years by the neuropsychologist and philosopher Jesse Prince as a central part of his argument in his book, The Conscious Brain. Now, I have to add one caveat to the idea that it's the pronunciation that's doing the work of creating experience. There's a difference between hearing a pronunciation that's linked to a concept, let's say a pronunciation, famous dentist, and one that's not connected to a concept, say, Atkin Adarab. This isn't quite right. experiencing famous dentists as a little extra something, not the whole form of the concept, but a feeling of meaningfulness, the ability to call up visual images and draw inferences. Akin Adarab lacks this feeling. But where does this feeling of meaningfulness come from? It can't just come by magic. The brain has to compute it. Everything you're conscious of has to be coded somehow or another by the brain. And in fact, the feeling of meaningfulness can be based on the existence of a link between the pronunciation you hear and the concept that you don't hear. When there isn't a link from pronunciation to a concept, you still hear a stretch of language, but it's nonsense words. You can think of the presence or absence of a link as being detected by a monitor in the brain that says yes or no. But there doesn't seem to be a good word for the output of this process. I'll call it a character tag. That adds a field to the field to the pronunciation, and that would be meaningful versus meaningless. Going back to the unconscious meaning hypothesis, I want to focus on the term imagery. The experience of inner speech is, of course, an image rather than the sensation of someone speaking. The speech sounds involved can be exactly the same, but the overt speech is sensed in as being in the world, and speech is in your head. How come? Well, the impression that it's in the world or in the head also has to be computed by the brain somehow or another. This computation could be based on whether or not there's a linkage between an incoming sensory signal and the percept, in this case, pronunciation. If there is a link, you experience the speech as out there. If there isn't, you experience it as imagery. So this gives us another character tag. External versus internal. Sorry, I'm not keeping up with my PowerPoint here. The combination of the two character tags gives us four sorts of experience. If a stretch of pronunciation is tagged as meaningful and external, we experience it as normal speech. If it's tagged as meaningful and internal, we experience it as inner speech. If it's tagged meaningless and external, it's someone uttering nonsense syllables. If it's meaningless and internal, it's imagined nonsense syllables, which we can do. So we can think of schizophrenics who hear voices as experiencing stresses of meaningful pronunciation that are internally generated, but erroneously tagged as external. So the pronunciation is serving as what we might call a conscious handle for the unconscious concept. It gives the experience form, and the character tags are feelings or modes of presentation that go along with it. And together, these two components are the conscious vehicle of thought. And now, I didn't just make this analysis up to analyze language. We can construct a similar analysis for visual consciousness. So I'll use the term visual surface for what you're processing bottom up from the retina and what you would reproduce in a picture. This contrasts with what you might call visual meaning. That's your understanding of the actual shapes of objects. They're full shape, even the parts you can't see, like their backs and insides, the part that Helmholtz was talking about. The visual meaning is based on the visual surface, but goes beyond it. So here's an illustration of the difference. This is a bookcase. Oh yeah, no, it's actually a bookcase with a cat behind it. Well, they look the same, but they're understood differently. There's a different visual meaning to the very same visual surface. Or the two ways of understanding the famous duck-rabbit figure, they present exactly the same signal to the eyes. Again, the same visual surface, but different visual understanding. This is just like the ambiguity of visiting relatives can be dangerous. So what's shaping conscious visual form is the visual surface. The visual understanding is, again, unconscious. And so we can account for these with this very same character tags that we used for language. External versus internal is visual perception versus visual imagery. Visual perception is driven by the eyes, and imagery is all generated from inside. And meaningful versus meaningless also occurs. So here's something that I take to be meaningless, that becomes meaningful when you get it, though there's nothing in the sensory field that's changed. So there's supposedly a Dalmatian in here someplace. I can find it sometimes. Where's my cursor? I can't find my cursor. Well, the head of the Dalmatian is right in the middle of the figure, if you can see it. Anyway, it's meaningless. It's just a bunch of splotches if you first view it. And if you can see the Dalmatian, then it becomes at least partly meaningful. We can think of hallucinations as experiences that are internally generated but erroneously come with the character tag external. And again, we experience dreams as external, even though they're purely generated internally. Let me give you one more case of a character tag. Think about the experience of producing speech voluntarily versus the experience of hearing someone else speak. In either case, the conscious linguistic structure is still phonological form, but the distinction can be made between a feature self-controlled versus non-self-controlled. You experience your own speech as self-controlled and someone else's speech as non-self-controlled. Here's your ego coming in here, I guess. This feature has to be, that is expressed by this distinction, has to be computed by whatever brain mechanism is responsible for the volitional initiation of action, or the experience of the volitional initiation of action. So we can combine the three features in eight different ways to characterize different kinds of experience. If it's meaningful or not, it's I'm hearing language versus I'm hearing nonsense. And whether it's meaningful or not, if it's external and self-controlled, you experience it as I'm speaking. If it's non-self-controlled and external, someone else is speaking. If it's internal and self-controlled, I'm talking to myself, that's inner speech. If it's internal and non-self-controlled, I'm hearing unbidden inner speech. Again, hallucinations are when you're producing unbidden inner speech, but tagging it as external and non-self-controlled. And speech in a dream is obviously produced internally without conscious structures, but you experience it as external and real. Skipped a page. So with all this in mind, what does the unconscious meaning hypothesis say about the nature of consciousness? Let me review what I've said so far. The components of linguistic consciousness are the pronunciation plus associated character tags, meaningfulness, external, internal, self-controlled, and others that I am not talking about today. Similarly, the components of visual consciousness are the visual surface plus associated character tags. The same tags, that's important. It's the same tags, but they accompany altogether different content. This is really different from what consciousness is generally made out to be. I'm going to mention some prestigious theories very quickly. A lot of people think, as you gathered at the beginning, that consciousness is the basis of thought. I think we can associate this view with people like Bernard Bars and Stan Dehaene. But according to the unconscious meaning hypothesis, this is wrong. What's conscious is pronunciation. Pronunciation is not the basis of thought. Meaning is, and meaning is not conscious. Another view is, I associate this with Christoph Koch, consciousness is the mind's summary of everything that's being processed, particularly the things that are causing difficulty. Again, no. According to the unconscious meaning hypothesis, pronunciation is linked to some of the concepts the mind is processing, but the concepts are not conscious. Another popular one that I associate, for example, with Doug Hofstadter, is that consciousness is the mind's model of itself. There it's focusing on self-consciousness rather than ordinary consciousness of the visual or linguistic field. And the character tags do reflect the mind's monitoring what structures are linked up to what other structures. This is a model of what the brain is doing, but it's a very crude one. The rest of consciousness experience is pronunciation, and that's, if anything, a model of speech sounds. It's not a model of the overall state of things in the brain. Now, I don't know how Freud's version of consciousness fits into this, but most discussions of consciousness, if they talk about language at all, just talk about consciousness of language as a whole, and they don't make the distinction between pronunciation and the structure of meaning. So they miss the fundamental observation that grounds the unconscious meaning hypothesis. I don't think Freud makes this distinction either. Even in talking about vision, they typically miss the distinction between the visual surface and visual understanding. And the unconscious meaning hypothesis comes out with such a different answer from these approaches because it's examining the phenomenology more closely. And it does this in the context of a highly articulated theory of what kinds of data structures there are in the mind and what kind of work each one does. Okay, take a deep breath. This completes the first half of my talk. We could stop here for questions, but I think we would never get back to the talk, so I'd like to go on. With all this deeply, firmly in mind, I hope you got it right, I want to turn to another question, which is, what's the nature of rational thinking? And this may look totally unrelated to what I've been discussing, but I hope to show you that the unconscious meaning hypothesis plays a central role in answering it. Now, the ideal is that rational thinking makes every step of reasoning conscious and explicit with no hidden assumptions. And the explicit steps are expressed in language. So this is Descartes' view, for example, in the Discourse on Method. I think formal logic is an attempt to achieve this ideal where they try to run inferences on form alone, mechanically, with no mistakes, no reliances on gut feelings. Any sort of computational model of reasoning has the same goal, I think. But this ideal is actually impossible. And here are five reasons why. First one comes from Lewis Carroll's little essay, What the Tortoise Said to Achilles. It's reprinted in Doug Hofstadter's Gödel, Escher, Bach. Let's take a random syllogism, I'll call it A. All houses on Golden Street are worth over $600,000. My house is a house on Golden Street, therefore my house is worth over $600,000. What makes this a valid syllogism? Well, following Aristotle, we would say any syllogism of form B is valid. All X's are Y, Z is an X, therefore Z is Y. But how does that prove that A is valid? To prove that A is valid, you're tacitly invoking a hidden syllogism that I'll call C, which goes, all syllogisms of form B are valid. A is a syllogism of form B, therefore syllogism A is valid. But how do we know C is valid? Well, there's another hidden syllogism. All syllogisms of form B are valid. C is a syllogism of form B. Therefore, syllogism C is valid. And I'm sure you can see what the next step is. How do we know D is valid? And so on. In an attempt to be completely explicit, in even this trivial bit of logic, we're drawn into an infinite regress. We can't be completely explicit. Here's another argument coming from people as different as Wittgenstein and Kant, namely, how do you know you've applied the rules correctly? So to see that syllogism A is an instance of syllogism B, you have to line up the steps of the of A with its prototype B. You have to say all houses on Golden Street in A lines up with or fills the variable of all X's in B. Worth over $600,000 in A lines up with Y in B, and my house in A lines up with Z in B. Well, how do you know you've done this right? In order to see if you've done this right, you need a further rule that tells us how to line up parts of syllogisms with the general pattern. How do we know we've applied that correctly? And so forth, another infinite regress. Now consider syllogism E. Why? All houses on Golden Street are clumped together in one block. My house is a house on Golden Street. Therefore, my house is clumped together in one block. What? That's not a valid syllogism. And we have to ask, why not? Well, you might say, well, clumped together has a different logical form from worth $600,000. It has to apply to an aggregate. That is, and a house is not an aggregate. But now, how do you decide that clumped together is a different logical form from worth $600? Deciding whether we have a bona fide case of syllogism B depends on knowing its logical form, which is not out there on the surface. It's not present to consciousness, except for the feeling that something is wrong. So it's not rational. Here's another kind of argument that you can't be totally rational. This one comes from Carl Lashley, who writes, "No activity of mind is ever conscious. In validating a syllogism, we have no awareness of the mental process by which we get from lines 1 and 2 to line 3. We only have this intuitive sense of the output of the process, saying, yes, it's valid, no, it's not valid, yes, it follows, or no, it doesn't follow. And what's this intuitive sense? Well, it's some sort of unconscious computation that's performed on a meaning, and it results in a character tag that's associated with the sentence. Yes, it makes sense versus no, it doesn't. So finally, going back to the unconscious meaning hypothesis, I concluded that conscious language in which the thought process is made explicit consists only of pronunciations plus character tags. The actual work of inference going through the syllogism is done unconsciously on the conceptual structure. So the big conclusion I draw from all this is that rational thinking is not an alternative to intuitive thinking. Rather, it depends on intuitive thinking, that is, unconscious thinking. At the same time, rational thinking is, as it were, clothed in language, which provides unconscious thinking a conscious handle of pronunciation. So this result, I think, is what Kahneman calls system 2. What this means is that you can never be perfectly explicit because there are always intuitive steps, that is system 1 steps, in any act of reasoning. The best you can do is be more explicit, be sensitive to gaps, and avoid confirmation bias, that is self-interest or judging true what you want to be true. Learning to do this, what we often call critical thinking, I think is like learning any skill or craft, and it requires a combination of explicit explanation and intuitive getting it. Just as an aside, would we want to be perfectly rational anyway? Like Descartes said, how much rational thinking do we actually do? And how much do we simply take on faith? Do we look for rational explanations of everything in our lives? Things like, where does our food come from? How do our computers and cell phones work? How are our clothes, dishes, and tools manufactured? Do you pick your friends rationally? Do you pick your profession rationally? I don't think so, not entirely. Even if you make lists of pro and cons, it's still a judgment call at the end that has to come from some sort of unconscious reasoning. But if we can't be totally rational, we might ask, if we can't be totally rational, we can still ask, why does it help to be apparently rational using languages? And here's 7 ways. These are things that you can't do with any other sort of conscious process like visual imagery. First one is that the handle of pronunciation enables us to pay attention to the thought and hold it in memory and retrieve it when we need it. And a sentence expresses not just the content of a thought, but its character tags. It lets us make the character tags explicit and conscious. So if I say, there's a cat on the mat, I'm not only talking about a situation of a cat being on the mat, I'm expressing my conviction that this corresponds to reality. That's a character tag. There isn't a cat on the mat, it's dissent. So it doesn't work, is the character tag. Is there a cat on the mat? There's a cat on the mat. We're considering this, but we're noncommittal about it. So you can attend to character tags in the form of sentences and express these associated feelings explicitly. You can ask yourself, is there really a cat on the mat? You can't do this with a visual image. Another thing is language can initiate a search for reasons or causes. So suppose we ask, why is there a cat on the mat? Where we're committed to the cat on the mat, but we're noncommittal about the reason. You can't ask a why question. You can't give a reason in terms of visual imagery, only in language. And why questions are among the primary generators of scientific inquiry, but also, and probably more important from an evolutionary point of view, they're a generator of inquiry into people's motives. So why did she say that, I wonder? Language allows us to make judgments of consistency among sentences, whether you think they're true or not. So you can say, if today is Tuesday, then tomorrow's Wednesday. You can manipulate these connections. You can say, if today is Tuesday, is tomorrow Thursday? You can understand and maintain two thoughts as alternatives to each other. You can say, either it's snowing or I'm dreaming. Or you can say, either John or Bill ate the leftover pasta. These are all things you could not do with visual imagery. And these procedures enable us to examine our reasoning and break it into smaller steps, just what Descartes wanted rational thinking to do. We can't do these manipulations with unconscious thoughts, and we can't represent these connections with visual imagery. So the phonological handles provided by language are a fantastic tool for enhancing and enriching thinking. It goes beyond that. Conscious linguistic support is necessary in order to attain, to learn many important aspects, or invent many important aspects of the human conceptual system. For example, rules of games, the past, organized religion, the number system, and concepts that depend on the number system, like finance and science. So much of the power of human thought comes from linking conscious phonological structure, which allows us to individuate and identify concepts, to map that to unconscious conceptual structure, where the actual processes of reasoning are carried out. On the other hand, it's not all sweetness and light. There are also some pitfalls of apparently rational thinking, and I'll just list four of them. The first one is that hearing a word leads to the assumption that there's a sharp category boundary, and opposite sides of the boundary call for sharply distinct responses. So either it's a dog or it's not. Well, what do we say about dog-wolf hybrids? What are they? They must be either dogs or wolves. Or more consequentially, either it's a murder or it's not. And now you have to take a stand on whether abortion is a murder or not. And they're quite different consequences on the two judgments. Or either it's genocide. Oh, these examples are all about death, I'm sorry. Either it's genocide or it's not. So are 3 murders enough to count as genocide? No. Are 6 million? Yes. What about 2,000? What about 150,000? What about 1 million? Well, these are consequential in political relations between the United States and Turkey. It matters. But who's to say? That is, language tends to make categories too rigid, where there are a lot of gray areas between them that we don't notice. We just fight about them. Second, and related to this, is if there isn't a word for something, it tends to be invisible. So if you believe that language is essential to thinking, then what do you say about what monkeys do? There's no alternative but to shrug it off as not thinking. It's just brute instinct. But if we manage to notice this problem, then maybe we can invent a new word for whatever it is that monkeys do. Let's call it schminking. Then we have an alternative. We can ask, does thinking, which is what we do, the same as schminking, what monkeys do, plus language? Or is thinking, are thinking and schminking completely different? So lacking the word, we can't ask those questions. A third pitfall, quite different one, is that you can put words together with just an aura of meaningfulness. And I'm afraid we academics are guilty of this a lot of the time. So here's a quote. I won't tell you who it is. I don't think of consciousness as something that happens in us, to us, but as something that we achieve or something that we do through our action and interaction with the world around us. This sounds profound, but I have no idea what he's saying. Finally, our reasoning is still only as good as the intuitive judgments that support the connection, to saying, yeah, it follows, or no, it doesn't. We can't always tell if it's rational thinking. Or are we just rationalizing? Here's symptoms of rationalizing, which I'm sure you as therapists are used to. Namely, giving reasons all the time for the same conclusion. So pardon my politics, but for example, these date back a ways. We should go to war because they harbor people who attacked us. We should go to war because they have weapons of mass destruction. We should go to war because they don't respect women's rights. We should go to war because blah, blah, blah. Or lowering taxes will create jobs, even though it hasn't. Lowering taxes will keep inflation down, even though it hasn't. Government should be kept off our backs, but not when it comes to abortion and gay marriage, and so on. And my point is not whether these are true or false or anything, it's just that they all feel rational to at least some of their proponents. And we can ask, what are you and I rationalizing about? From the inside, we have no way to tell. The best we can do is to watch for cues from our physical and social environments that conflict with our convictions. And maybe we should be paying more attention to our therapists. I don't know. Anyway, being alert to the possibility that you might be wrong at least keeps you modest. But that leads to a different sort of problem. How and when can we avoid the paralysis of self-doubt and move on? Well, that's an intuitive judgment too. So we can't avoid intuitive judgments all over the place. So on that sober note, maybe it's sober, maybe it's not. Let me summarize. Although we often experience our thought as inner speech, the speech is not the thought. It's only the conscious handle of the thought, which is while the thought is itself unconscious. The ideal of rational thought, in which every step is made explicit, comes from a widespread but incorrect conviction that thought is nothing but language. Third, what we experience as rational thought is riding on top of a robust base of intuitive thought. Having conscious handles from language enhances our thought vastly, but this doesn't excuse us from carefully examining our intuitions of rationality, which we can't make fully conscious. Are these good conclusions or bad ones? Are they welcome or unwelcome? I think you'll have to judge for yourself. For me, this is just the way it came out. I don't know whether I like it or not, though I do like some things about it. In particular, it gives some room to validate a lot of aspects of our life that are hard to justify rationally. Things like the value of tradition, such as it is, our love of the arts, including not just literature and music and art, but good food and nicely decorated homes. It validates some of the intuitions and feelings behind morality and religion, and the intuitions that lie behind good teaching. But that's a whole other discussion, so I'll stop here. I'm hoping you'll see ways to bring all this junk to bear on issues in psychoanalytic theory. So thanks again for having me, and many thanks in general. Is somebody going to unmute?
Yeah. I thought I did that. Can I be heard?
Am
I?
You're heard? Unmuted. Yeah. Ray. Could you stop sharing your screen?
Yeah.
Great. Wonderful job. Go ahead, Morris.
Oh. Okay. Thank you very much. That was a lot to take in and think about, and very demanding and close listening. I had two thoughts. I don't know if they're even questions, having to do with visual surfaces, visual perception and meaning. When I was listening to you, what came to mind is a description of, and this has to do with the distinction between movements and action. I recall reading a description in a book called Autobiography of a Schizophrenic Girl. The analyst was Marguerite Sechahaya. She describes the breakdown, the beginning of her breakdown. She's watching a group of kids jumping rope. They're in a rope jumping game. And like many of us would, she experiences that as these kids engaging in the meaningful action of a game. And the beginning of a breakdown occurs when she sees the kids, and instead of seeing them as engaged in a game, she sees their behavior as disconnected movements, which have no meaning at all, or which are robotic-like. Mm-hmm. And so without using the term meaning technically, what, in your view, the notion of meaning, what has actually gone wrong there that leads to the experience? I mean, I guess the visual surface is still a robotic movement, is still a meaning.
Well, maybe it's not. I mean, it's now, or it's not attributing meaning to the participants. I'm not sure.
Yeah.
It's an interesting case, but I mean, it's a screw up with a character tag.
Yeah.
Sure.
Mm-hmm. Can I ask
a
question? You know, business about unconscious meaning and that it's the pronunciation that's conscious. It gives you a handle, but the actual meaning goes on unconsciously. What about the issue of affect, emotion? What Freud talks about, you know, that by definition, affect is conscious. And if there is anything unconscious going on about it, it's essentially physiological in nature. And therefore, there is no such thing as unconscious affect, even though he allows himself to stretch the situation and refer to it. What role would that play in your account, I'm wondering?
I don't know exactly. I have not thought a lot about emotion. It's too hard. But the closest I've got is a character tag about something about this thing that I'm perceiving matters. Uh-huh. Where mattering can have either a positive or negative valence. Mm-hmm. And some things don't matter at all. Mm-hmm. You know, the noise outside didn't matter until I paid attention to it, kind of thing. It was just there. So whether this matters positively or negatively, that would be, seem to me to be the entree into talking about affect more generally.
Okay, thank you.
All I can do is give you places to connect, but I can't give you the connection.
Thank you. Mm-hmm.
Somebody else going to unmute themselves?
Or raise their hand or...
Yeah. Or something. There you are. Okay. Are you moderating or asking a question?
you hear me?
I'm going to make I found it very interesting, of course, that, going back to a lot of concepts and things that I haven't thought about as much lately. So I have some... a comment in response to what you had said, that you leave it to us to say, how does this connect to what we do? One of the ways it connects is that in talking about dreaming, which was where Freud started to build his model, he talked about the visual dream could not pictorially represent certain kinds of what I think in logic you might call logical operators, like no, for example, but also the kind of things that show up in syntax as the logical connectors for sentence, if then, because, and so on, that is the connectors between propositions. So he, in my view, the mistake he made was to say that this was a sort of more primitive thinking and tied it into children and earlier species, earlier forms of existence, rather than to see the difference as mediational. So there can be no in an image, because that is the whole sila sinapas and peep. You know, this is not a pipe, because you cannot have a non-image, except maybe in psychoanalysis, because there have been people who've talked about negative hallucinations. So there is that connection in terms of what you're saying, I think, to some of what we tend to be thinking about in terms of how things are represented and the difference between, I think he related this to some sort of type of thinking rather than to the difference in the media. There is, in using and ignoring that difference in the media between imagery and verbal representation, he got himself into a lot of trouble, I think. So I think one of the things you were talking about is the reflexivity of language, that it can refer to itself. You know, like rat is it is the meta language and is also the object language, right? Mm-hmm. Rat is a three-letter word, right? And so that kind of reflexivity, I'm wondering what you think about the notion that another difference between vision and language is that in speaking, there is always a feedback loop. When you're speaking, you hear yourself speaking. When you're seeing, you don't see yourself seeing. And so I'm wondering what you think about that. Also, do you see any developmental changes in the concepts and these, which you're saying are unconscious, once the phonology comes on as these handles, or another way I think some people thought about it is as a sort of addresses, a way of getting to the concepts?
Mm-hmm. I don't know how this applies in development, although, you know, the research that I'm familiar with suggests that they have to have the concept before they can learn the word properly, at least at the earlier stages. There, later on, when you have a certain amount of linguistic skeleton in place, you can use the language to help you learn what this new word means. So I think the prime case of that was Barbara Landau and Lila Gleitman's work with the blind children, mm-hmm. who were using the word see quite appropriately. And evidently they'd learned it by its use in sentences where they knew the rest of the sentence. They knew the structure, and it was only revealed that they had a strange concept when they said, look for the X, whatever it was, and they went like this. Mm-hmm. They're feeling around for it. So it, for them, seeing meant using the primary means of perception. Mm-hmm. But they could get that far just on the basis of hearing the context in which it appeared in the language. I think that's all I have to say about that point. Let me go back to the one about you hear yourself speaking, but you don't see yourself seeing. I think the proper analogy is you don't hear yourself hearing, right? I mean, if you're talking about visual perception, you want to compare that to language perception. The other one, if you had a little TV screen on your head that you could generate pictures, that would be the equivalent of speaking. So maybe we have to compare it to action, and you do observe yourself acting, moving from place to place. And for action, there's no notion of action. Well, action perception is understanding other people's actions, I suppose. And again, when you're watching somebody else's actions, well, we heard this morning about people who with brain damage who will reproduce actions that they're perceiving. So that is some kind of feedback, I suppose. And then your first point was that dreams can't express logical connectives. And I think you're right that, you know, if you are speaking in a dream, you can speak logical connectives and understand them. It's just the vision, it's the properties of the medium of visual imagery that don't permit you to do logical connectives, which are basically unconscious ways of collecting concepts. I don't mean collecting, of connecting concepts. Does that sort of answer your question?
Right. On the last point, I think Freud was trying to think his way through that, and said, just as a rule, that if language appears in dreams, it is not really produced by the unconscious. It is an auditory trace. It is something that somebody has heard. It is not creative. So it would be, it has become reduced, as it were, to its auditory imagery, as an auditory image.
That can't be true, because you understand what people are saying in your dreams, right? You're responding to them. They're responding to you.
Right.
Telling you stories, who knows what. So it must be that you're generating whole sentences or fragments of sentences, you know, internally. When you're dreaming, you're experiencing them as real. I don't know, does anybody report experiences of really dreaming and asking if they're dreaming and coming up with the answer yes?
Lucid dreams.
I've had that experience.
Have you?
Yeah, I've had the experience of a dream that's very disturbing, and then in the dream, not often, but in the dream, I will say to myself, "It's only a dream."
You do. So
it's not that bad.
Well, there's also this thing called lucid dreaming, which are people can train themselves to have the kind of dream that they want, to walk down the road that they wanted to dream. And there are whole societies that cultivate this and compare notes about the control of the dream that will appear.
Can I ask a question that's informational? Maybe it's informational. Because it was such a complex and rich presentation, it was hard to take it away.
I'm sorry to throw all that stuff
out. That's right. But I think I'm going to ask maybe a simple question, or maybe not. Are you juxtaposing rational and intuitive? In other words, when you talk about rational thought, it seemed at some point it was necessarily syllogism-based, and then you question at levels, and pitfalls in it. So I guess that's the first question. Are you juxtaposing rational and intuitive and defining rational as syllogism-based?
No, I'm just using syllogism as the simple example.
Sure, but the general.
But the general thing is that I think that, you know, there is a premium placed on rational thinking, and we want to get away from that primitive stuff that's intuitive thinking, or alternatively, if it's something like achieving nirvana, you know, then it's intuitive and then it's wonderful. Okay.
Can you have rational thought such as that's out of the verbal system, like musicians and painters? Are they working rationally or are they not working rationally?
I think, you know, what we call rational thought, I'm claiming is a combination of linguistic support for parts of it and intuitive judgments to make the connections among them. In the User's Guide to Thought and Meaning, I have a chapter where I'm rehearsing the Brahms Clarinet Quintet. And there's something going on in the violins that I don't like, and we're trying to fix it. And you're asking things like, what did Brahms mean by this marking? And if we do it this way, this is a consequence of the way it comes, the way the whole passage sounds. If we use this bowing, it doesn't work. So there's all the symptoms of rational thinking going on, but the judgments in the end are, is this a convincing way to play this piece? And the judgment has to be yes or no. And in fact, I disagree with my co-conspirators in this activity, and we never do settle it. But the way we talk, the way we work on music, it has all of the trappings of rationality, but the judgment at the end is not totally a consequence of what's been argued. It's in a nonverbal medium. Does that make sense?
No, well, I mean, it does, yeah, I know. But so Beethoven's composing is intuitive, not rational, but not irrational.
Well, it's kind of, there's some rationality too. I mean, you can see, in the case of Beethoven, it's interesting because he left a lot of sketchbooks. And you can see him working on pieces. And he says, no, and he's saying to himself something like, no, that doesn't work right. I have to, let's try something else. And what you have available to you as you learn the skill is a repertoire of things to try and a sharpening of the intuition as to what sounds good and what doesn't. And, you know, the distinction between rational and intuitive is hard to draw in cases like that. It's just such a mixture of things.
So the great flow of creativity that comes in is not rational, but it's not irrational. It's something else.
It's not irrational. I mean, the term we have, again, it's one of these things where we may not have the right vocabulary and we have to invent technical terms. But for the moment, we'll let intuitive do the work for us. Okay, and it's some mishmash of rational language-guided thinking and intuitive judgment.
Okay, I guess just for the record, that's where I use the term subsymbolic to account for this flow of experience mm-hmm. that is not irrational, but not able to be broken down into its discrete elements.
Well, it may be that it can be broken down, but not by the experiencer. I mean, it can be broken down by doing neuroscience.
Sure, that's a different level. That's right. Not a different level.
Right.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. So we're asking, what are the brain mechanisms behind this experience?
I was asking if he's equating rational and linguistic language.
Harry, why don't you go?
Pardon?
Harry has got his hand up.
Yeah, can you hear me?
Okay, go ahead.
I have two questions. Thank you for the presentation. Any thoughts about the idea of the language of thought within the context of what you're talking about?
Yeah.
And the second question is, how do new ideas, new concepts get developed within this structure that you're describing?
Okay, actually, those are related questions, important questions. The term language of thought goes back, I suppose, most prominently to Jerry Fodor. And Jerry concluded, he said there has to be some lingua franca that's independent of the choice of language, but cuts across various modalities, I guess. But he thought that it has to be propositional, which I deny because of music, for example, and even visual perception. He really wanted it to be propositional. And he wanted to say that it is in some way directly related to the world. Which is impossible because your thinking really is buried very deep inside the brain. It has no contact to the real world. Nevertheless, there has to be some representational form or forms that constitute the computations of our thought. So in that respect, I agree with Fodor. There has to be some way that all of these, that you can operate on concepts, there has to be some form for concepts and some way of operating upon them that allows us to reason. Now, the other part of this, and this is an argument that Fodor almost made, but not quite, is that there seems to be an unlimited number of concepts that we can come up with, and not just through syntactic combination, even within word meanings. Oh, but among all the cultures of the world, there's basically an unlimited number of possible things that you could mean, possible concepts that you could achieve. And so we can apply the same argument to concepts that Chomsky applied to sentences. We say, look, this means that you cannot memorize all the possible concepts and just pick the ones that your culture happens to use as words. Rather, there has to be some sort of system that gives you primitive building blocks and ways of combining them to build new concepts and the old concepts which you stored. And this means that you should be somehow thinking about conceptual primitives, and that is very controversial. I happen to think that it's very hard to find them, but they must be there in order for us to be able to think up new concepts. And a lot of my work in semantic theory has been in search of digging down farther and farther. Sometimes it's you think you've got a primitive, and it turns out that no, you get a better account of the whole system if you break this primitive down into a bunch of features that it shares with other things, and you get whole systems of pieces of meaning. I'm not sure that's enough to satisfy you. Is there more to the question? I mean, I've been talking in very abstract terms.
That's what you got, that's fine. I think one of the arguments against a language of thought was, if you have a language of thought, why bother with any other language at that point?
Well, the good answer is language of thought doesn't have phonology. So you can't get it out of your head without a language, which is a language is a way of translating concepts into phonology and then from there making them into overt signals that you can communicate. And in fact, you can't achieve the concepts of your language, the concepts expressed by your language, without hearing language. So the phonology is essential for individuating concepts and knowing that there are concepts there to be learned. And in fact, using the concepts, expressing the concepts. So you need a vehicle of thought so you can communicate. And it just so happens that once you have that, you get verbal imagery for free by turning off the production mechanisms, but leaving the concepts and the syntax and phonology in place.
Move over a second.
Yes.
Hi, thanks. That was a very exceptionally rationally structured talk. It was beautiful. I wondered just a few quick questions of clarification.
Yeah.
I was a little confused, this is my confusion, I think, about what parts of meaning you were allowing to be in the phenomenological universe and what parts of meaning you were still keeping down there in the computational universe that we're not privy to. Indirectly. And I was thinking, on the one hand, I really liked what you were doing because, contrary to a certain view that was popular, there was a popular view that there are representations, but their causal relations are just causal relations and there's no phenomenology of that, versus the view that whether something, a representation, is a belief or desire has a phenomenological component. And Freud actually, in his discussion of the unconscious, goes with the very cognitivist view. He says all there are in the unconscious are representations and their cathexes, their causal powers. Interesting. But what you were saying with these tags allows phenomenological senses about what you're saying or what is going on, what you're feeling and experiencing, to be there. You have a lot of stuff that you can experience. And what I was wondering was, how much are you allowing in there? So, for instance, with the just take a simple example that you gave, the duck rabbit. It seems like I was unclear. We obviously experience it. Okay, granted, the stimulation to the eye is identical, but our experience is of it as a duck or a rabbit, let's say. So. Where's the part that's not in phenomenology? Obviously, there's something going on that makes the difference between in our brain, obviously, between that those two meanings. But it seems to me that the meanings are entirely phenomenologically accessible in that sense. So what am I missing? What
yeah, I mean, the form in which the, I guess what's it's really hard to say this again. I think we lack vocabulary for thinking about this. That the, if you ask about what's the form of the experience, the pieces, the form is the form of phonology. What the phonology is about, what it expresses, its form isn't open to consciousness. What does affect experience or phenomenology is the character tags. Now, this gets really tricky. If you're looking at the duck rabbit and you're saying this is a duck, so you're experiencing it as a duck, it still has the same form, sort of phenomenological form, the same qualia if you're being a philosopher, right? Nevertheless, there's the sense that this connects to the word duck, and you can experience the word duck. And so you say, oh, there's a connection between that thing out there in the world and this word duck that I utter or experience as inner speech. But if we try to talk about the mechanism in between those two, it's all unconscious.
But that, doesn't that seem to, I mean, going back to Merleau-Ponty, but many, many others, it seems like the problem is your description you just gave is not one that a lot of people would report as their experience. That is, the experience isn't, I see this pattern, and I associate it, in this instance, with the word duck rather than rabbit, and something in my brain is therefore processing in a certain way. No, the experience is, that is a duck. I can't even see the rabbit. That's a duck.
Yeah, yeah.
Or your experience is, that's a rabbit. Now, I'm not sure, I think you're holding that I have to have the word in my head when I see it that way. I'm not sure even if that's true. I might see it as a duck or as a rabbit without even accessing the word. Does that go, would that be a problem for your view if the phenomenology is that rich?
This is the problem I run up against every time I talk about this. So,
okay, sorry.
Not alone.
Sorry to be
not alone.
The repetition compulsion.
No, I'm getting the repetition, sort of looking out for the repetition every time. You know, it's really hard to it's really hard to convince people that this is the way they're experiencing things, which is very difficult. I mean, I can't argue you out of your view of the phenomenology, right? All I can do is to say, when the phenomenology has distinctions in it, how are those generated from what's going on in the cognitive structures? And that's as far as I can get. And it seems to me that when we talk about inner speech, it's the same as outer speech. How does outer speech relate to things, right? How do you experience it? Well, you experience it as being about the world, blah, blah, blah. But the immediate form that it takes is phonological. This is the reason why it's easy to train people to detect rhymes and count syllables and look for particular speech sounds, but it's really hard, and to characterize those things, but it's really hard to do any semantics whatsoever. You know, even the most basic things people have been arguing about for decades and decades. And that seems to me sort of a methodological reason to view my position as correct. We have conscious access to the parts of pronunciation, but we can't decompose the concepts intuitively.
But with regard to for the phonological aspect of it, two things occur to me, and I'm wondering what you think. There's a good deal of evidence. Originally, you know, we were all skeptical that you can get subliminal processing at the semantic level without any phonology, at least without any conscious phonology. So if it were just subliminal priming of a non-semantic thought, that would be interesting, but it wouldn't be relevant to your talk. But how do you get semantic encoding without any phonological, at least conscious phonological component at all? That's one question. I'm wondering if that's relevant. The other related one is, does your model encompass the kind of experience where you have an intuition and you're not giving, it's not as if the pronunciation captures, well, it's not as if the pronunciation is there along with the intuition, but you look for a phonological or pronunciation to capture the intuition so you could use it later. Mm-hmm. It's like, you know, Einstein talks about his kinesthetic sensations as a source of his thinking and his discoveries. So, and he obviously had to do something with those kinesthetic sensations in order to write papers about his thoughts. So those are two areas where the phonological, its role is not that obvious. And I wondered what you thought about both examples.
So you were going kind of fast. I missed the first one. So let me answer the second one first and then we'll go back.
Okay.
So it's not as though phonology is the only medium of experience. Mm-hmm. We have visual experience, which I'm claiming is coming from the visual surface. Mm-hmm. We have kinesthetic experience, which we can remember and reproduce. Right? You need that to learn how to do gymnastics or whatever, or play the piano, or you know, use a screwdriver. So we have to say connected with each of the senses, in fact, is something that's responsible for experience in that domain. And yet at the same time, they have to communicate with each other. So with a sense of haptics, the sense of touch, where you can determine the shapes of objects just by feeling them, somehow that has to connect with this visual experience of the shape or visual coding of the shape. So you can say you can feel something and you see it finally and you say, oh, that's the right shape. So you'd be surprised if you're handling a sphere and all of a sudden you look at it and it's a cube, something like that. So there has to be communication between the different domains of cognition. And their experiences are quite different. So you know whether it's a haptic sensation in your experience or a visual one in your experience or both, but you don't know how they connect it up with one another, which is at the level of conceptual structure or some central coding that involves spatial configuration or something like that. I may have given two narrow a picture of what's going on, but the thing is, and these other domains can be used for thought. So think about trying to pack a bunch of boxes into the trunk of your car and trying to find a way to make them all fit. That's basically done in spatial terms. You may have language like, oh shit, it doesn't work this way, let's try something else, but the actual reasoning is done in the spatial domain.
Yeah,
I think.
With regard to semantic subliminal coding,
oh yeah,
at the semantic level, what is that?
We want to say a lot of our cognition is not so different from that of non-linguistic organisms like chimpanzees. So mm-hmm. whatever we need to code for their governing their actions and perceptions, we want to be able to carry that over. Or let's say if we're doing human cognition, we want to say, let's borrow as much as we can from our primate forebears. And that's without any linguistic support. And to the extent that young infants can do things that are demonstrably cognitive, we want to say they're doing it without the benefit of language.
Oh, but here the phenomenon that I'm talking about is encoding to the semantic level without any possibility of any, either phonological or any of the other senses playing a role, because the subliminal stimulus is out of awareness and inaccessible. That's the issue.
But what kind of stimulus do you have in mind?
For example, this was one of the early studies a lot of people here will remember at the NYU Research Center. If you expose the word happy subliminally, mask it with a subsequent stimulus, the person merely experiences a flash of light.
Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm.
And however, the semantic meaning of happy, that it's primed other responses, can be demonstrated by its subsequent influences. So you might see a neutral face as happier than a control condition. It's that sort of.
Yeah, phenomenon. Okay. Well, there, of course, there is language because you're using the word happy.
That's right. That's right.
But you're arranging it so that it gets in without experiencing it. And there right. We have to talk about how much activation does it take to make something conscious versus how much activation does it take to influence what's happening next.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And so it's sort of a matter of timing of buildup of activation, I think.
So what's the handle on it, though, if it's...
Oh, the handle is slow.
Doesn't exist, or...
Yeah, the handle is getting you in there because you're getting the word happy, but it doesn't appear in experience because,
uh-huh.
Right, it is activated enough to pass on information to semantics, but not activated enough to produce awareness of the stimulus itself.
Right, so the pronunciation doesn't have to be conscious and deliberate.
Right.
Okay.
Yeah, so I have a question. Yeah. You, answering Morris's question, you said something about packing a trunk with different objects and view that. And I wonder, do you not view that as part of rational thought?
I would view that as outward thought. The problem is that people usually use rational thought to mean thought that is accompanied with language. So, but this is, I would say this is clearly thought, and it's reasoned thought, and it's probably, you know, you're conscious of the effort of thinking, though it's not clear, and you might generate some images of how you want it to end up.
Well, some people think for them, conscious major thought processes, for example, I'm a mathematician.
Mm-hmm.
I spent many years doing research in geometry and topology. And for me, thought was all this jumble of images going through my mind that it took great effort to put into words after I had solved my problem. But the real thought was far away from language, it occurred in these geometric images.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, this is parallel to, I think, what I was saying about music. That is, you're coding it, and you're doing what we might call rational thinking about it, but not in a linguistic form. And we're aware of the images the same way as we're aware of linguistic imagery when we're reasoning using language. Does that make sense?
Yes. I mean,
and I'm told that, let's say, architects, for example, don't think in language at all. And many of them are dyslexic, in fact. So they that they think in spatial terms.
Were they always images, though? Were they images or?
Well, they're images
or some other forms.
Well, I think of them as images, but they are... You can't grab them. You can't say you can't specify them. I'm thinking about infinitely many objects going in infinitely many different directions and different infinite dimensional spaces. So it's they're images and yet they're not quite images.
Uh-huh. Well, All I can say is that they're probably experienced as visual, but we don't know anything about representations in that domain, really, the way we know about language. Right. I've been trying to get people working on vision to think about, you know, sort of the grammar of spatial understanding, and there's very little work on that.
Yeah. The other domain I often think of is athletics. Mm-hmm. I mean, think of the basketball player who is thinking rapidly at great intensity, but there's no language there because there's no time to put it into language. It's, you've got to see what your opponent is doing and react to it.
Absolutely, absolutely.
Okay. Larry and Mauricio and Anne have been waiting for a while with their hands raised. Maybe we should try to give them a chance to get in too. But Ray, if I cut you off, I'm sorry.
Oh, that's fine. That's fine. I was about to get lost.
Larry, you've been waiting for a while.
Oh. Where's Larry?
Where's Larry?
Oh, there's
Larry. Are you unmuted, Larry?
I'm trying. Can you hear me?
I think. Yes. Yeah.
No, yes. I have a couple of vague questions. I just wondered what your stance was. The first one was, and I'm thinking of the intuitive aspect of this joint effort that you speak about, and your emphasis on irrationality, which strikes me as pretty much descriptive of the human condition, as we see it today, definitely illuminated. I wondered what you thought about Piagetian framework for thinking, and in particular, I don't know if that's relevant to the next question, which is when you talked about contact with the world. Am I completely out of the picture of what you're describing? If one were to ask you, can intuition be trained in some respect, that aspect of things, for example, by science or by a mathematician in his lifetime work, would he then have would the compound that you're describing be so random as far as the effectively determined as what you call the intuitive aspect of thinking for a mathematician in his field or a scientist while he's working? And I can imagine some Piagetian elaboration, but is this an irrelevant question? I think you could dismiss it and move on to the next.
No, I think that's very important. I think that a lot of, this is when I talked about critical thinking as a craft, I think that's exactly what I had in mind, what you're describing. That is, what you're doing is getting strengthening and sharpening your intuitions and getting a better repertoire of possibilities to try, some of which you use consciously, let's do this, and some you don't even know, you might call them habits or something, but they're very complicated. And if you're training as an athlete or you're training as a musician or you're training as a scientist, there are anecdotes of people saying, I finally figured out what it means to be doing this in this field. You know, I remember a friend of mine saying, I finally figured out my third year of graduate school, what linguistics was about and what it meant to do it. And then he went on to try to write a book on methodology of doing linguistics. And it was terrible because he was trying to describe his intuitions and he didn't get it right. Or I had the experience in music where I was in a master class with a famous cellist and he's correcting this person's performance. And he says, no, you have to do such and such. And then he goes to demonstrate and he does something completely different, which was the right way to do it. That is, his intuition was good, but his conscious description of his intuition was completely off. So there is the disconnect, but I think that learning to any sort of craft involves honing your intuitions, possibly with linguistic help. But you eventually have to get it.
But would that be true too for just plain thinking? For example, when you spoke, when you gave us the deductive, ad infinitum line, of faith, we could imagine, and I can imagine people who would need intuition for the first step. My diagnosis of that is when you say to somebody, the counterfact conditional, when you say to somebody, yes, you say this, but suppose this were the case, and he says, but it isn't. Now there's a person, you know, that's stopped at that level. It isn't that you have to get down to, so wouldn't there be a difference in what you say is the component of intuition in that kind of thinking between somebody at the top level who can't move into a syllogism from somebody who can trace it down, so to speak, to where, you know, you've got him against the corner where he can't, you know, he has to use his intuition to affirm any syllogism.
Is this like the difference? Maybe not. Let me just try this. I mean, is this like a beginning tennis player and a tennis pro? Or beginning pianist and a professional pianist?
Well, sometimes it's that, but isn't it more sometimes people are more ruled by their intuitions? They're not willing to pursue something. That's the general category of intuition when you described it. I'm maybe misunderstanding you, that it was sort of the same for everybody. We're all pretty much at the disposal. Oh, we think we're thinking, but we're really, you know, just using a handle more or less. And everything is really pretty much decided, which is a good analytic premise, by, you know, their gut, to use
it. Yeah, well, I mean, some of it is getting sensitive to signals that something isn't quite right. Right? I mean, all inquiry, I think, is based on saying, oh, there's something wrong here, or I don't understand this. So it's based on that sort of intuition. I would say that these differences that you're talking about are differences in accessing the handle or using the handle properly, or using that, we can't talk about properly, let's say using the handle productively, or if they're denying, they say, but I don't have a cow, or there aren't any, you know, whatever the denials are. Those can be from, I think in your business, these can be conflicts from all sorts of other unconscious patterns that are laid in, that, of which you have no awareness, but they dominate your reasoning. And some of the training has to involve breaking down the interfering conceptual frames. But maybe we're getting too far afield here. I don't know. As for Piaget, I'm trying to remember. I can't remember what he said about consciousness, so I better not try to comment on it.
All set, Larry?
Yes, thank you.
Mauricio?
Let's see if I understood. Correct me if I'm wrong. What you're one of the main points you're making, Ray, is that animals have conceptual thoughts. So there's also intuitive thoughts, and we can't equate. We can't think that language is the way we think conceptually, because animals already have concepts and they don't have language, and there's intuitions without language. So then the question comes, okay, what is the function of language? What did language bring to us humans that was an evolutionary advantage? What was the function of language? And if I understand you correctly, that one of the functions of language is what you're calling character tags. Do I have that right?
Mm-hmm.
It provides character tags.
Well, it makes them explicit.
It makes us explicit. So I want to ask you what you think. I don't know if you've ever come up about a book that came out last year about language. It's called the instruction of imagination, language as a social communication technology by Daniel Dorr. He's at the University of Tel Aviv. And my way of understanding what Daniel Dorr is trying to get to is that one thing that language did as a communicative tool is it instructed them, it is able to put our imagination in from new perspectives. So say, if you're a hunter and gatherer, you know, and you wanted to describe that you have seen some fruits or you have seen a predator far away and it wasn't visible, language permitted us to describe past, present, and future and imagine that we could imagine that animal even though it wasn't present in our visual field. So it instructed, it created a multitude ways of looking at the world from multiple perspectives, which is another way of saying it provided multiple ways of using our imagination. So put imagination on steroids, so to speak. And I wonder if you're familiar with this author, and I wonder what you think of that idea.
I know a little bit of Daniel Dorr's work. I haven't looked at it recently, although I had a conversation with my colleague Dan Dennett about it not too long ago. But I think the answer is, first of all, other animals do show evidence of imagining. So there's all of this stuff on dead reckoning, finding your way back to the nest, where you have to keep in mind a direction. You have to sum up all the directions that you've taken and somehow find a trajectory to get you back in a straight line. There's the, I forget which animal it is or which bird that caches nuts in many, many, many locations and then comes back and gets them, knows where to go. So somehow they're imagining where these things are and then, you know, when they're not in view. So it does take you away and some evidence, a sense of time. I'm trying to think of the book Galistel and King come to mind for a lot of stuff on animal behaviors that look rather intelligent. However, I gave this whole list of things that you can do with language. One of them, maybe the most important, is you can coordinate a lot more with other individuals. And you can communicate about the past and you can communicate about the future. You can plan collectively rather than individually. There's no evidence for that apparently in the primate literature or the wolf literature. I don't know about dolphins. But in any event, but there's this whole bunch of other things that you can do, which is hypothetical reasoning, numbers above four. I mean, there's a lot of evidence that many animals can keep track of four objects, up to four objects. Some of them, the limits are smaller. Babies can do about as well as the animals. When they start learning the number sequence, which requires language, then they catch on to the idea of number as a potentially unlimited number of numbers, right? So in terms of evolution, there's all kinds of different motivations for finding an advantage to language. And I suppose the possible problem is those opportunities seem to have only been available to people. So why don't chimps talk? Why don't tigers talk? And so on. What was the difference that led to the possibility of evolving a language capacity? And I don't know, Tomasello thinks it's so something to do with sociality. Probably partly right. I don't know what else. But it's what I disagree with is Chomsky's view that it's just something that accidentally sprang into existence, fully formed. I don't know. Does that answer your question? or have I been carrying on irrelevant details?
No, I was. You did address my question, and the interesting question of what was the function of language. And by the way, I do agree with Tomasello and many others that it has to do with our ability to communicate in social groups in much more effective ways. I mean, that had to be at least one of the functions. And that was, I think, Dorr's idea as language as a communicative technology, and I assume you don't disagree with that.
Right. As I recall, he thinks, though, that it's completely a cultural invention, which I don't think is the case. Tomasello hints at this, I think. I think it requires some change in the genome that allows certain kinds of perception, certain kinds of computation, certain kinds of processing that are not available. And so the big question in linguistic theory, I think, is what is the human language capacity, and how can we account for it in terms that are evolvable? And of course, since we don't know anything about how genes build a brain and how brains actually compute language, we're a long way from being able to answer those questions.
If I just might say something to what you said, Ray, I think their position would be is that language is not unlike culture evolution. What distinguishes us from perhaps other species is that we have the capacity to pass on from generation to generations cultural knowledge that accumulates. So eventually we can get to the moon. So as I understand, the argument is language is the same. It's the process of of the cumulative effect of cultural language and developing arbitrary symbols like dog that doesn't have any perceptual representation as opposed to some symbols that are iconic. These symbols are totally symbolic, and that's just part of the cultural evolution of our species.
Yes.
That would be their position, I think.
Yeah, I would disagree with that. I think you have to put something else into the brain. You can't just say, well, we'll get social beings that without language and somehow they'll be smart enough to invent language, and isn't that great once they invent it? It does a lot of good once you have it, but how you get from, let's say, a chimp model to a Homo sapiens, maybe Neanderthal. It looks like the evidence is beginning to come in that Neanderthals had some version of language, but we don't know what it was like.
Just to be fair to that position, they would say that key issue is learning. We're also the only animal that can learn,
Yeah, but that's false. That's false. I mean, Animals can learn all kinds of things.
Well,
And they're not very good at learning words the way kids learn words. And to the extent that they can't invent them. And of course, their social systems are much less complex than ours as well. So, is it just growing a bigger brain, or is there something qualitatively different in the brain? I think that's an open question. The problem is that, as I was saying last night, there's this dogma that you want to make do with as little innate structure as possible, and so we're going to assume that it's innate and condemn any attempts to parcel out what's innate and what's domain general. And, a lot of my work in semantics has been, if there are these elements of meaning, can you find them in a primate conceptual system? And a lot of the stuff about space, yes. Some of the stuff about social organization, yes, some of it, no. And I've been able to find some principles of linguistic organization that appear in other domains, but other things that aren't, as far as I know. I think it's really an open question. I'm doing my best to resist the impulses to oversimplify the problem and say it just happened. once you got social enough, or it just happened because of one genetic change, or it happened because, yeah, or it's, well, see, I mean, culture is, gives you the same problem. I mean, learning that there are aspects of culture, learning your particular culture has to be founded on a, on some sort of a basis of what to expect of a culture, what you're looking for, what kinds of issues are important in cultures. And those don't come for free either. You can't learn that kin are important. It isn't that every new chimp or every new tiger learns that kin are important. Those things have to be built into the brain somehow or another. We don't know how. So you can't get something for nothing here. I don't know if that's helping or making things go off the rails even further.
Well, we'll just have to leave it for there. That's I have some thoughts about that, but I don't want to, I want others to have an opportunity to talk.
Well, we do have a, you know, a fair bit of time. If Wilma and Morris both have a question, if it's on this, and then Ann, you've been waiting, so then after that. But go ahead.
It's not on this. It's on something else.
Okay, then let's give Ann a chance. Sure. Wilma, is it on this? Is it on this, Wilma?
Yeah, it is on this. In fact,
okay, go ahead.
Just to respond further to Maurizio, there are just too many language universals for all of that to be accounted for by learning or by culture. Far too many. I presume that you know the book by Berwick and Chomsky on, what's it called? Something like Why Among Us? Yeah. Yeah. What do you think of that book? And
I actually think
an evolutionary biologist.
Yeah, I think it's a terrible book, actually.
Yeah, it's not very good, right?
In the sense that they are assuming a certain model of grammar, which they don't say a whole lot about, but which there's an extensive community doing that notion, that version of grammar. And, you know, it's just terrible stuff. I hate to be so condemnatory, but I've written many, many, many things about what's wrong with this approach. And I'm just seeing it going on at MIT in all the talks on linguistics there. It's just a really very, it's so far away from learnability that, and it's so complicated for the simplest things that I just don't think it can be right. And it doesn't account for all kinds of things that a little richer account provides for. But you're up against these two things. You want to account for the richness of languages on one hand, and the need to evolve them out of some primate prototype. And those two are in tension with one another. And we just have to see how it works out.
So I really didn't want that. That's just a stray thought. I wanted to
real
mention.
Question now. Yeah.
Go sorry? Ahead.
The real question now.
The real question. Not questions so much as observations. Those of us who work with patients and patients' dreams, I've been particularly interested in how patients represent semantic concepts via plastic word representations in dreams, via images. And so, and they're so rich and imaginative. So for example, someone who was talking about, who was complaining about somebody in their department, and it was accused of something, and then they were exonerated, and the whole thing was a whitewash, dreams of doing the laundry and separating dark wash and from whitewash. And someone else who recognizes that the badness, the trouble in their marriage is identical to the kind of problems her parents had, and that she and her father are in exactly the same position vis-a-vis their mate. And dreams of, comes in and says, he had a dream of a rowboat, and she and her father were in the same boat. And that's all, you know, and the ability to do that is so remarkable, and of course entirely out of awareness. So that was one observation I wanted to make. And the other one was
Well, can I just break in on that a second? There is awareness. It's aware. It's the dream is conscious. The dream is an experience, but how it's produced is totally unconscious.
Right.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Okay. Right. Go on.
By the way, the interpretation of the dream isn't conscious either until we work on it a little bit. And I get it. I didn't at first get it either.
Yeah.
The dream of the boat was exactly her situation in her marriage. That took a little while for both of us to come to, but when it did, it's so clear exactly.
Right, but that's it, character tag.
Right.
Right.
Exactly. And my second question is also about character tags and the issue of individual differences in intuitive ability.
Mm.
One has the experience teaching students at a university or training candidates at a psychoanalytic institute, that some of them understand they understand intellectually what's required of them, and they listen to patient material and they can talk about it intellectually, but in working with a patient, they just don't get it. And it's those character tags that seem to be missing. I never had a way of thinking about what do I mean when I think to myself, this guy just doesn't get it. Mm-hmm. He doesn't get what this field is about. He doesn't get what he's doing with the patient. He just doesn't get it. And it seems to me that your description of these character tags might be a way of thinking about those moments.
That's not, those moments are coming without character tag to say, yeah, that's it.
They're thinking you've explained something to someone and they seem to understand it intellectually. And then they present you the material that they present you what they've done with the patient. And then your feeling is this person doesn't get it and they're never going to get it.
Yeah. I think
it must happen in every field.
I think, yeah, I was going to say
any kind of teacher. Music in.
Yeah. One of the things that you are trying to cultivate as a teacher, I think, is a proliferation of strategies to deal with problems. So my daughter is a math professional and she works on how to teach math to elementary school kids. And a lot of the work is trying to get beyond saying, here's the formula for how you add numbers, but figuring out what's different ways to get the answer, different strategies to tell whether you're on the right track, and this sort of thing. And again, you know, some kids get it immediately. They figure it out on their own without any external hints. And some kids will never get it. I don't know, isn't our word for this talent? We're not allowed to use words like that.
But do you have any thoughts about individual differences in that sort of intuitive ability?
Well, I think we all have differences in different domains. So somebody who might be talented at tennis is not talented in psychoanalysis, right? I don't know, my intuition is it's sort of like noses. Everybody has a nose, but they're all different shapes and sizes and fine details, and that makes a difference in how they look. Well, the same thing with behavior in different domains or facility in different cognitive domains. It may not be that different, but in terms of what you have to produce, it could be consequential, and there'll be bell curves for each of these domains. So this is getting into the area of Howard Gardner's multiple intelligences, kind of.
Okay.
I don't know that doesn't follow particularly from the story I've told you today, but that's the way things look from this end.
So I think I'm next. I have a quick
question. Go ahead, Wilma, and then Morris.
Okay. This is a quick question, and it may have a real quick answer or not. I don't know. Going back to the functions of language, the value of language, what it does for humans and how it works for humans. What do you think of the work of Andy Clark on words as entities outside of ourselves that we can manipulate, that become extensions in some way of human functioning?
I think it's sort of weird, actually. In that it's saying the word is out there, you still have to say what is the mind such that it appreciates words and that shapes words the way they to become the way they are.
Sure, but that doesn't have a function then. It has a function, it's a thing that is there to communicate.
Well, now you come to regard it as a thing that has its own life. So we have to ask, how do you conceptualize words like that way? What sort of metaphysics do we ascribe to words? And it's very much the same metaphysics we ascribe to tunes, actually. Where does a word live? Where does a tune live? Where is a word when it's not in people's heads? Is it distributed across all the heads of all the people who have that word? What are you doing when you're learning it? Is it the word invading you, or are you creating a structure in your head that conforms to what you perceive other people to be doing? And it seems to me Andy Clark is sort of giving himself all the hard parts, helping himself to all the hard parts.
Please make this structure, as he says, a linguistic scaffolding of some sort, as a structure that we share, that we
do.
That makes a basis for communication. It's outside ourselves, like our, in a sense, like our iPhones. They're part of us, but they're out there.
Well, not really. I mean, I think that's, you can think of language as a tool. So is it like a hammer, or is it like a nail, except a tool you make at a certain time and you use it you make it at a certain time and you know what it's made out of and blah, blah, blah. Whereas a word, where is it? It doesn't have a location unless you say it's in people's heads, and then you have to say, then you're back in my world, right? You're saying, how do words manage to be in people's heads such that they take them to have some metaphysical existence?
Let me throw in something. You mentioned the cell phone. I think that in the mathematics behind the cell phone is a lot of new words coming in as generalizations of old concepts. So the something like the first generalization is you have a dog, and then you have the idea of dogs or animals, or I'm missing some genera, some in between. In mathematics, they keep generalizing and making new concepts out of old ideas.
It's building a world.
Building worlds. And the new words are important because you need a word to describe a concept that has the structure, the definition of the concept is too complicated. You can't hold it all. But you can't hold the word in your mind as you build new structures. And that's all part of, I believe, what went into the mathematics behind, for example, cell phones or flying.
Yeah, well, the question of how words get invented and catch on is a very complicated one. Yeah. Also complicated is, you give a definition of a word, and sure enough, somebody will find someplace where the definition doesn't work, or you want to apply the definition and it's too broad or it's ambiguous, and then you have to start clarifying again. And those are all really complex dynamic processes in language change. And they're way beyond what I can talk about today and probably what I could talk about ever. But there are people who deal with this sort of thing. One of the cases, let me just mention one thing that you may or may not have heard of. There are these situations where a number of of deaf individuals have been collected into one place. So the most famous example is Nicaragua, where there was no provision for the deaf before, and then the Sandinistas opened up a school for the deaf in Managua. And all of a sudden, all these kids came who had had no exposure to language, and within a very short period of time, they were communicating with each other, and their means of communication has been studied intensively now for about 40 years. And what we see is it keeps getting more and more complex and more expressive and looking more and more like a developed language. And there are other cases of this now that have been documented. A student of mine is working on a village sign language in Turkey, where there are about 20 some individuals who use the sign language. And it's in pretty rudimentary by the lights of developed languages that we know and love, but they're using it in all the ways that language gets used. And it seems to be gaining in complexity. So there's a real place where you can talk about the invention of language. Those signs weren't waiting there out in the world for the people to discover them. It was certainly a human invention. That partly answers Wilma's question as well.
Right, yes.
About Daniel Doerr. And I should say, the people who believe that language is just a cultural invention that's based on imitating what you hear other people say is completely at a loss when you try to talk about the development of these village sign languages and the emergent sign languages. It has nothing to say, because what they're doing is elaborating on what they see. And in the first generation, all they have is the co-speech gesture of their adults, the adults around them. And the second generation sees the very rudimentary sign language and elaborates it further. And by the third or fourth generation, it starts looking pretty well organized. And that depends on the size of the community and all kinds of other things as well. But we can see this invention in progress, and it's fascinating.
About Morris and Larry?
Yeah, I just wanted to ask about two odd phenomena. One is not so odd. The first one is the odd one. The phenomenon of, and what occurred to me, it might be interesting to you because it has to do with a link between the pronunciation and the further unconscious processes that generate meaning. The phenomenon is called satiation.
Oh, yeah.
If you keep repeating a word over and over and over again, literally pronounce it over and over and over again, it loses its meaning. And I'm wondering whether it's sort of impairing the normal use of pronunciation, which is to lead its connection to further processing. And what you do in satiation with this repeated pronunciation, you kind of deform that function. So that's the first question. I wonder if that makes sense to you and fits in with your formulation regarding pronunciation and other processes. That's the first question.
Shall I answer that before you get to the second so I don't forget it?
Yes.
I seem to be doing. First of all, I mean, the experience could be described as switching the character tag from meaningful to meaningless.
That's right.
So I don't know whether the repetition is working on the link or on the concept itself.
I see. Yeah, that's interesting.
But then I guess what you would want to do is look at other cases like that. I think there are cases where if you immobilize the eye, all of a sudden things start disappearing.
Yeah, I've published a paper on that. It's called Stabilized Retinal Image.
Okay, and I mean, it's sort of the same kind of thing. And there may be other cases I can't think of. It's funny, somebody just mentioned this to me the other day. So.
Mm-hmm. The second. It's not so much a question, but sort of sharing an experience. And I wonder, it may not fit in at all, but where you have the same semantic meaning. Many of us have had this experience. I've had it. Let's say I listen to something spoken in English, a proper, let's say, British pronunciation. Then I'll hear the same sentence in Yiddish, which goes back to my early experiences, and is a totally different affective reaction to the sentences. It's a surplus, I don't know whether surplus meaning is a good way of describing it, but certainly it goes beyond simply pronunciation or a strict semantic meaning. It has to do with, and also even goes beyond, well, it might be character tag. It just occurred to me that would be one way of wondering what you thought about that.
Yeah, well, so this is the affect that goes with the mama lotion, right?
That's right. That's right.
And I suppose I would, the first guess would be treated as a character tag, but it's a character tag on the language feature. So you have to store in your head words and phrases and constructions and grammatical principles from the two languages. And those have to be separate, kept separate from each other. There are times when it's appropriate to switch from one to the other, but for the most part, you stay in one rather than the other.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's really the character tag, if anything, is attached to the language feature of all of these things, of the whole set, or to the language feature of, maybe the language feature is some sort of a monitor. I don't know how you want to characterize it, but it would be attached to the thing that identifies this as whatever language it is. And everybody who has the equivalent of a mama lotion has the same experience, as far as I can tell. I mean, my collaborator recently grew up in East Germany and lives in the Netherlands, and she loves to speak her old East Berlin dialect. You know, when she finds somebody who speaks the that dialect, she just says, "Oh, I'm home." You know,
right?
So. I think that's how I would characterize it. Now the question of, you know, what is that feeling? That's out of my, you know, over my pay scale. Or it's your business, I don't know, in characterizing forms of emotion and attachment and stuff.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Go ahead, Larry, and then Phyllis.
I'm sort of backward, I think, in this. Probably because I have the least knowledge of the specialty. I wondered, you a minute ago, you spoke about, you used the word talented in reference, I think, to thinking or to using the tool of speech or of language together with intuition. And I wondered what was your notion of talent? What would talent represent in the way that you've set this up? I was just curious. Maybe again, this may be a question that does not belong in the domain that you're talking. But if it does, could you say?
Well, I mean, all I can say is it's you're good at things. It comes to you naturally. This is thinking, playing the piano, playing tennis, fixing things, cooking.
What would make you say good at? I mean, what is the what is it? What's the
goodness? You do it naturally without too much instruction. If you're given instruction, you get to it right away. You invent new ways of doing things on your own without instruction.
They're successful things. You're doing something. I mean, if you were just impulsive and you did it very fluidly and you do it easily and it's really stupid and it doesn't work, that's not talent. Talent is that you accomplish something of a certain sort. And I wonder that would be in thinking.
Oh, in thinking, it's okay. In the case of thinking, it's whatever, you know, it's reasoning through problems, I guess. Knowing, being able to plan activities without difficulty. I don't know what else. And maybe, again, I'm getting over my head, but I mean, this came up in the context of saying, well, I'm trying to train somebody to do something and they just don't get it. And I'm trying to train somebody else. And not only did they get it, they finish the semester's work in 2 weeks and they're way ahead of everybody else in the class at doing this and so forth, whatever that happens to be. I mean, I'm using this in a very non-technical sense, except observing that it occurs in just about every domain that's of interest to us.
If you were speaking about thinking and you're talking about how we reach conclusion, is there a way of speaking about being talented in a non-technical way, or aren't you automatically committed in some way to, so to speak, to a greater logic, you might say, of intuition?
Well, I don't know. I mean, what do people say they're doing when they're teaching critical thinking? It's being able to look at a text and get the information out of it, to raise questions about it, to think of things it's connected to, and to be able to do that with a certain amount of fluidity. I can't go much beyond that, but those are the things that, somebody who really does that without much effort, we would say is talent. We don't usually use the word talent in that respect. We say they're smart. but you wouldn't say a basketball player is smart because he plays basketball well. So I'm trying to get beyond smart, the purely thought-based thing, and say it generalizes with other talents in the way it presents itself across a population, let's say.
Go ahead, fellas.
I was thinking about Anne's candidates that she was talking about who don't quite get it, even though they have the cognitive and conceptual understanding of, what to say to the patient, but they don't quite get it as an affective problem, or it's almost like a kind of music that they don't hear and that they can't really respond to, that it's a kind of dissociative issue. And sometimes in certain people is as a result of trauma of a certain kind, like a mother who doesn't hear her baby cry. There is a kind of either psychic deafness or dissociation or splitting off of the affect, from the content of it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That sounds right to me, Phyllis, and that's why I don't think calling it talent is really going to come.
I'm not sure it's talent at all. Yeah.
Well, it's whatever it is, I'm happy to go with it. I mean, from the point of view of pathology, now we have to, I've been talking in terms of sort of normal people without, that normal people, we're all normal people in some sense, but let's say things that deserve therapeutic treatment or something, the people who come to you and their unresolved conflicts and trauma and so forth. How does, from my perspective, it's just a question of saying, what is actually going wrong in the process? How are things intruding? But that doesn't really help you when you're trying to treat it. Or maybe it would, I don't know. But I'm operating at a much more basic level where I'm not really prepared to talk about those sorts of effects. This is just sort of laying down the first layer of a foundation that might someday prove useful. There, about 25 years ago, I was at a little workshop organized by Marty Horowitz. Does this name ring a bell, you folks? And I wasn't sure what I was doing there, but I wrote a talk that got published, and there was this, what I thought was a pretty clever idea, that there are laws of rational thought that we all worry about in logic courses and so forth. And then there are rules of irrational thought, which include things like projection, where you say, there is some anger here. Oh, it's not me. It must be you. And so we could think in terms of laws of irrational logic as things that people are obeying that give them pathological symptoms. But I don't know what to make of that. Mm-hmm. It was kind of a joke.
Well, are there any other questions?
Just one comment about irrational thought and projection. I just read an interesting study. The situation is actually more complex. I just read an interesting study on prisoners who were convicted of aggressive crimes. And the interesting finding was that they're, no surprise, they're far more sensitive to aggressive cues, hostile cues in the other. But they're also far better at it. In other words, it isn't simply a matter of projection, but a matter of picking up just that information that is relevant to the hostility of the other, which is actually there. It's not projected. So what works there is selectivity rather than, and it's not inaccurate. It's actually quite accurate, mm-hmm. but it's a selective sensitivity to the very things that they're concerned with and on guard against. So there's not that clear distinction between, you know, rational thought, irrational thought, projection, reality. It's far more complex than that.
Always.
Well, I want to thank you, Ray, for a stimulating and interesting talk. Thank you. For all the time you took to all, take all the questions. Really appreciate your involvement in the conference.
Well, thanks for having me. It's been fun. Seeing, being an interlocutor with people from such a different world from mine. So it's good. See you tomorrow morning.
Yes, right. And just about tomorrow, I'll open up this room, we call it, at 8:30. And then we have a business meeting at 9:00. And that's just for members, 9 to 10. And then we'll have our last talk at 10 in the morning.
It's what time?
At 10 in the morning is the talk, and okay. 9:00. 9:00 is the business meeting.
Right.
Yeah, okay. Okay.
Bye. Bye.
Hey, baby.
Paolo, did you get the recording?